here in Melbourne, Australia, still. Handsome Rambler Podcast, Al Jackson, special guest, comedy legend, Franklin Najjar. Did I say it wrong?
No, that's
okay.
Good.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I didn't know I was a legend. Like, people told me that in the States, and I said, well, why aren't I working? I can't figure out the connection, you know?
What'd you say? Yeah. Did you burn some bridges, or did your friends
It was just a different... Like, you know, what's interesting is when I was a younger comedian, you know, I was dealing with Richard and then Eddie and then Def Comedy Jam, and my style, which is low key, was really kind of swamped during that time. And I had a tough time as a black comedian because I wasn't really raucous enough, as you know, which after. So,
when'd you start?
I started in 72.
Okay.
Yeah, I started. Most of that time, most of the black comedians were pretty mellow. You know, I came up after Dick Gregory and Cosby, and who told me to send you his regards.
Yeah,
and,
tell him I say the same.
And so the tradition of black comics were pretty much low key. And I came up. I liked Carlin Pryor and Robert Klein in particular. Right. You know, those were my three kind of models. And that counterculture, kind of rebellious comedy, but very low key. I was always kind of low key. But then I kind of got lost, you know, when the comedy got more raucous, the black comedians got more raucous, and that became to be kind of expected. Yeah. Then but I think the tide has turned because, you know, Dave is low key, you're low key.
Michael Che is low key.
I don't know who he is. When I was here, people used to email me and say, there's a comedian in the States. Reminds me of you. And then when I said, who is it? Cause I used to get that email a lot from different people. I said, who? They said, it's a guy named Dave Chappelle. So ironically, I went back over to the States in 2005 to do Deadwood, right? Mm-hmm. And I ran into Dave at the Comedy Store. They was doing a benefit and I was there and he was there. So we got to chat and first of all, I did my thing and then Dave did his thing and I actually listened to him first time and I went, wow, I can see why they say he's similar to me. And we chatted afterwards and he said, I used to come see you all the time in Washington, D.C. I used to sit in the front row and he had my album, Don't Smoke Dope, Fry Your Hair, he told me. And he named all these places I had been in D.C.
Wow.
That he would see me. And I'd forgotten all these places. So I went, oh, okay. All right. Because I didn't know. And I thought, so I used to think I had no influence over anybody's comedy. You know, I just thought, well, I'm not going to be, not that I wanted to be influential, but I used to see when I saw that I would talk to young comedians down at the Uptown Comedy, and they were all very high energy,
right?
You know, and they'd all come out, 5-6 of them, all high energy. And I'd say, well, you know, you can't really distinguish yourself if you're all going to be high energy, you know, and why don't you try talking to them a little bit more? But that seemed to be a lost kind of thing.
Well, I had that. I remember doing a set on the south side of Chicago. Yeah, I'll never forget. I had this set. It was a kind of a black open mic, and I did my and it was my first couple years ago. And I did all right. It was pretty bad, actually. And then I was in the bathroom. There was another comedian, and he said, "Man, your material is good, but you gotta yell at these motherfuckers."
You know, it's funny that you say that because that's actually true. Because I had some young black comedians come up to me because I did this thing, Comic View for BET, and I judged some comedians and I tried to talk to them about. And a lot of them said, "Oh, I really like your material. It's really smart, but the black audiences won't let me do that." I got that comment from a lot of young black comedians. They won't let us do what you're doing. So I had to tell them something which was kind of interesting because when I started, of course, there were not really black clubs to like they like this. But you know, I worked the folk rock clubs.
Yeah,
I worked the Bitter Inn, and there's a place in Georgetown called the what the fuck is that? I forget the name of
Bitter Inn. Hendrix started there too.
Jimmy Pryor. I did Village Gate. I did all the tours. When I started touring in 72, all you would play were the folk rock clubs.
Yeah.
The Troubadour, the Bitter Inn, the Cellar Door in D.C., Paul's Mall in Boston, Ebbets Field in Denver, the place in Philadelphia, the Bijou. And I would always be the opening act for a musical act, you know, either a folk or a jazz act, mostly jazz, you know. So that was actually really great because the musicians really liked my act, and it was perfect for me to be with a jazz act because they bring an audience that's ready for abstract stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, and so it was ideal. Then all of a sudden the comedy boomed, and then I started headlining at the comedy clubs. But also, I was making a lot more money, and of course, you know, but I didn't enjoy it as much as when I worked with the musical acts,
right,
which was really more of like, I just kind of like that blend, you know.
Was the comedy boom, because I hear so much about it, that was the 80s,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so was it a gradual thing where all of a sudden it exploded, or was it out of nowhere, like, oh shit, I'm getting 10,000 a week? What was the, like, how did it, did you feel it? Like, oh well,
you know,
happening.
You know, the Improv was packed every night. Comedy Store was packed every night. Stars were dropping by.
Yeah.
I remember I was hanging out. Bruce Willis was in, Michael Fox, it was packed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally packed. You know, it was a booming. And of course, the clubs exploded, you know, all around the country, comedy clubs everywhere, which was dangerous because that was a saturation. And you had all those shows like Evening at the Improv. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and I did this show a long time ago called Make Me Laugh, which was actually the best show for my profile, because you were on five nights straight.
Oh, wait, explain the format?
The show was called Make Me Laugh, and they'd have like three comedians, and they'd bring out somebody, and they'd sit there in the chair,
yeah,
and your thing was to make them laugh, like in 30 minutes or a minute or something like that.
So, wait, is the audience?
There was an audience there, but yeah, there was also, they'd bring out this one person who'd sit in the chair, and their whole thing was to try to not laugh.
Yeah.
And so, you'd have about three contestants, and you come out and do your thing. I always made mine laugh, somehow, you know, but you were on five nights a week.
Right.
So what happened was, a lot of people could see you in that week. Whereas if you're doing a Tonight Show, they might see, you might do one, but they wouldn't see you for another one for 3 months.
Right.
That Make Me Laugh thing, I remember.
You could build, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because it was very popular. It was a very popular show at that time. But what happened was, the producer ended up stealing all this money, so they took all this, they took the show off the air.
Oh, man.
But yeah, the producer stole all this money. So, but so I remember people.
It's so easy to steal in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah, right. Little tracking system.
The executive producer. Not even, you just get a check. He was able to steal from the show.
I mean, what he stole, I mean, it was ridiculous. He had him a cash cow. It was going to be around for years, I think, the way it was so popular. I was on with Howie Mandel.
So he stole the money. He stole some money. And it tanked the show?
That's what I heard.
Yeah.
I heard that he embezzled, or he did a bunch of stuff, and next thing you know, the show was off the air. It was a syndicated show. It wasn't like on a regular network. It was Make Me Laugh. You could look it up, Google it, and you'll see. And that really, I remember, I got recognized a lot more.
Could you feel your audience
growing?
I could
feel it.
Yeah.
Because it was, you know, you had everybody young. We were all about the, Mandel was on, Bruce Baum.
Bruce Baum. Were people doing, like, so you had to make the person laugh. So you're doing
your bits. Yeah, yeah.
But it was no,
you come to him, you come, you know, I knew the bits I had, and you'd walk right up to him. He'd be sitting in a chair, and you start to do your bit to them.
Yeah.
You know, and I had some good stuff at that time, and they'd always kind of laugh. I'd crack them up. You know, and that was cool. But the boom, back to the booming thing, you know, you just, comedy clubs were everywhere. You had all of these brick, you know, you had A&E had Evening at the Improv, then you had the Laugh Factory had a show. I used to do that a lot too.
Yeah.
Okay, a TV show. And it was just booming.
Everybody's on TV making money.
But a cat said, you know, then he said, you know, there's too many comedians, which was true, and there's too many clubs. A guy said that, a comedian said, there's just too many, man. And that was, it just saturated, and people, mediocrity started to hit.
People just getting in the business to get some money. Yeah.
You know, because that's when it kind of changed. In the 80s, before then, people wanted to be a comedian to be a comedian. In the 80s, people wanted to be a comedian to be a sitcom star. That was the change in the attitude of the people getting into it. Because
what's my 5 minutes going to be that's going to lead me to?
That's going to lead me to, you know, because Jerry had his show, Roseanne had her show, Cosby had really hit, you know, you had Tim Allen.
Mm-hmm.
And it changed. They weren't really trying to be great comedians anymore. I tried to be, when I got into it, I saw the people that I really admired, and they were like inspirational to me. Carl and Richard and Klein in particular. I was kind of a synthesis of those three. I had a college education. Richard didn't have, I liked his kind of street oriented sensibility because I had gone to black high school and I could relate to it on that level. And I saw him, I remember on my 21st birthday at the Red Fox Club. Red Fox used to have a club. This is when Richard was
in LA?
Yeah, when Richard was exiled from TV and he went and changed his act from being clean to.
This is when he went to Berkeley?
Yeah. And he came back. A friend of mine called me from San Francisco, said, man, if you ever, but you probably just saw Richard Pryor in Berkeley, if you get a chance to see him in ever, you got to see him. This cat's really funny. And lo and behold, my birthday came up, and I saw he was playing at the Red Fox Club right there on La Cienega, and my girlfriend said, I'll take you to see him. And the interesting thing was...
How much were tickets?
75 cents. I have no idea. What was interesting was I didn't know what kind of material he was doing because I'd only see him doing the My Name is Rumpelstiltskin stuff. I didn't know he'd really changed into what he, you know, really did, telling the truth and cursing and all of that. So what was interesting was my girlfriend was white. She was a young girl. She was 18. I was 20. She was a little Catholic. You know, you really couldn't curse around her. Sweet, a real sweetheart, actually, from San Francisco. So we went to see him. And of course, Richard started cursing and doing his thing. And I remember she gasped initially when she started to hear the show, right?
Oh, yeah.
She went, but the funny thing was, it taught me a lesson was by the end of that show, she was absolutely hysterical.
Yeah.
She was, and I realized that the truth of something, because I thought, wow, I can't curse around her. And here's all this language and stuff, mm-hmm. right? And all these subject matter. And when we went back to the dormitory, she told everybody, you got to go see this cat. So I learned that the truth of what he was saying cut through all of the mm-hmm. other stuff.
Right.
You know,
her rules about language.
I mean, she was hysterical. So that's when I said, wow. And actually, that's when I really thought, well, maybe I can be a comedian because I had never seen.
You hadn't done it at this point.
Yeah, so. No, I hadn't done it. That was 1969 or 70.
Okay.
I had met him before, that crazy motherfucker. I was in college. This is an interesting story. I was in college and he had, he was doing a little movie at this house. He'd rented a house. And this friend of mine who was also funny, he said, hey, Richard Pryor's doing a movie. I'm in it. You want to come down and see if you can get in it? And I said, oh, yeah, okay, cool, okay. So I walked down and it was in this house. And I walked into the kitchen to meet him. And his then wife was there, right? And she was crying. I mean, she was cooking pork chops. That's what I remember. Because it's funny how you remember little details like that, right? She was cooking pork. They smelled pretty good, too. And she was cooking pork chops, and she was crying. And Richard was standing there across the room with a high hat and a blue peak. She was saying, I love you, Richard. I love you. And he kept saying, I know it, bitch. I know it. That's all he said.
Damn.
That's right. That's what he was saying. I know it, bitch. So then he came over to me. He pulled out this little... foil, and he said things go better with coke, and I you know, I turned that down. I said I don't do that. So then I got this little part.
Was you a blatant turn down, or
I smoke grass.
Would you
grass. Yeah. I'm a grass guy.
Yeah, you seem more mellow.
Yeah,
it's funny how that's a line in the sand. Usually guys go one way or the other. Yeah.
Yeah, coke. I saw what it did to some of my friends. It was everywhere in show business. All the bands had it.
Also, you know he's staunchly a grass smoker because he said grass.
Yeah.
He is a weed. Or that's
pot.
Grass.
So all the bands had it, so it was around me all the time. But I just saw that, you know, I was never self-destructive. And I had tried to learn from seeing performers who were self-destructive. And I saw people who were on coke a lot start to get agitated over time. Mm-hmm. And all I really wanted to smoke was just to calm me down because I was an anxious person in those days, very neurotic and stuff like that. So I just said, nah, that's cool. So he gave me a little part in the movie. It was a bizarre-ass movie. I don't know what it was like. A white man was on trial for all the crimes against black people, I was like washing him. And
so Richard Pryor deep cut.
Yeah, it was a jury. It was a jury of blacks there, and I'm washing this guy. I don't know what it mean. I worked 17 hours for $2 an hour. And he gave me a check for $34.
From Richard Pryor?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He handed it to him, and the motherfucker bounced.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Fucking bounced. And I never saw him again for like maybe 20 years, or, you know, 10 years. You know, by that time I was a comedian. I never mentioned it. Because he was so crazy, but I mean, I thought about it.
That's so real. Yeah, he's unstable.
He was. I used to call him nitroglycerin because it was like you didn't know what, you were going to get on a daily basis.
Did it make it difficult to be around him, or you just kind
of... For me, yeah, because I've never been around... I mean, look, I worked with him on Car Wash. I worked with him in Stir Crazy. I came up before him at the Comedy Store. I got maybe my best compliment ever in my whole career from him, because it was two nights. This is when he was really hot. And they put me on right before him at the Comedy Store. They were selling out because everybody knew he was going to be there. He was doing a whole week. That's where he recreated the Mudbone character. Mm-hmm. I saw him do that from day one. He came up with one line, and by the end of the week, he had the whole routine. That was quite interesting. And so I thought, well, I got to really be good. I had my album out. I had some good material. I don't smoke dope. So I said, I got some good stuff to myself. I'll see what I can do. So I went out up ahead of him, and I did a really good 20-minute fucking set, really hilarious set. And I thought, well, that's pretty fucking good. And then he came up. What was interesting, he came up on stage, and then he beat me. I mean, not that it was competitive, but you know that feeling of, wow. I said, oh, wow. He came up, he did this really better set.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay.
Objectively better set.
Yeah, well,
sometimes there's vibes where...
No, he was at his peak.
Famous, right. Yeah, yeah.
He was at his peak.
Yeah.
In those days, as a performer,
right?
He was playing a home game. I mean, the people were there to see him.
But he was, yeah.
I mean, I got tremendous laughs because I used to. It was so the next night.
So you would have. You were.
I was like, really.
You were a tough follow.
I was very, but that's what happened. The next night, I was even better. I really said, "Well, I got only one more night," and I really put out all the stops, right? And I really tore the fucking audience apart. I did my Disneyland High routine, which was my little classic at that time, and they finished, and as he walked up on stage, he looked at me like this, and then he walked up on stage and said, "That nigga's getting too funny." That's just what he said. And I went, wow. All right. And then he beat me again.
Yeah.
Because, and I was standing in the back watching, and I said, oh, he's got an extra gear. He's got a little extra gear right now. You know, I was just sitting there watching him, and I went, he's got an extra, and his gear was he was a better physical performer. Mm-hmm. Than I was. I could the way he move and use his body. I didn't use my body that way, and I said, "Well, I got to start to try to add that stuff." But he also, you know, he did that Mudbone routine. He had that. He just was at his peak in terms of his brilliance and the type of material. But I was very close. And then he came and came and saw me record one of my albums. He actually came, but George Carlin came and Pryor came. So I was kind of in that groove. Those were my guys, and but you know, at that time he was really. By the time my career ended, I actually felt I was better than him by the end because I had more. Richard couldn't talk about anything but the street because he didn't read, he didn't have an education. So, and then after the fire, he was never the same to me. His material wasn't as strong, even though he had a lot of goodwill. From the audience, I used to listen. A lot of times when I listen to comedy, I close my eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, if I really want to see if somebody's saying funny stuff to me, or I close my eyes and listen. And then I can really judge it more objectively, you know, because is this really sharp? Is this really... So I would listen to him and I'd say, oh, he's not what he used to be. But the audience loved him more because he'd gone through the fire. And,
right.
You know, and they had great sympathy for him. But I could tell, he's not what he was, you know. And he wasn't really reading and developing a wider...
He was kind of staying in his lane.
Staying right in that lane. And once he wasn't living crazy anymore, he didn't have much to talk about.
Okay? Which is, I think, what a fear of a lot of comics that do party and get super wild is like, when I get sober, what am I going to talk about? What kind of... What will I have, you know?
Yeah, and I think you know, you can do it. Look, I don't know. Look, I was neurotic, and a lot of people... Once I got kind of clear, and moving here did that, or seeing moving
on. When did that happen?
Well, what happened was I was really at the. I was struggling in 1985. I was having a bit of a tough with Robin Williams and high intensity comedy. I was having I had a slow style, and I was starting to get TV people say, "Can you speed up? Can you speed up more?
Yeah,
we need a certain amount of laughs per." And I went. You know, yeah, they were, and because Robin was influenced, you know, everybody, you know, it's like everybody, whoever's hot influences the scene, right? And Robin was frenetic.
I imagine Robin just killing places.
Imagine trying to follow that. Yeah.
Robin just destroying shit.
Frenetic.
See, but I would think that you would be perfect for bookers as the not antithesis, that's not the right, but the perfect balance, the yin and the yang to high energy comedy. It's like almost like where Stephen Wright, where like that kind of place where he fell into, you know, it's just like everybody.
Yeah, Stephen couldn't find, it's funny, I did a gig with Stephen, we did some colleges, and you know how for 30 minutes you can hang with Stephen, after 30 minutes he can get a little boring for people, yeah. Okay. So I used to come on before him, but by the third gig they said, look, we got to have Stephen come on before you because he was too low key for, he couldn't really follow me. But I just was having problems. And then I had a really terrible love breakup, you know, that was really had me spun out. And this guy, I was, actually came off the road at the time because I couldn't really perform. I couldn't perform. Well, depressed, like some people. Only time I ever got drunk on stage, I got drunk in Detroit just because I was so depressed. So I thought I drank these 3 Long Island iced teas before I went on stage.
Oh, you really were depressed.
Yeah. Yeah, I was Long Island. Depressed. Three of them. Yeah. Three of them. And that was just a disaster. And I remember when I came off the road, I told my agent, you know, get me off the fucking road. I can't do this. Like this. And I remember Jerry Seinfeld, I was talking to him walking down Santa Monica. Jerry can fucking work through anything. And
he's got a heavy schedule coming up 2017.
Yeah.
He's playing the Beacon Theater every month.
Nothing bothers him. Nothing fucking bothers him. It's amazing. So I remember I said, I think I'm coming off the road because I'm depressed. And he said, no. You got to press the organism. That's what he said. No, don't do that. Stay out there. Work through it. Press the organism. I said, no, I've saved up some money, so I'm going to do that until I get better. So then I got this call from my agent. He said, I got a gig in Australia. They want to bring some American comedians over for 2 months. They brought some from New York. That worked out well. They want to bring some from L.A., 3 comedians. Would you like to do it? I can't get any comedians to take the gig because they got to go away for 2 months and they don't want to leave the States for 2 months thinking it'll affect their career.
Like,
and I
went, yes,
I did. I went, well, you know,
I need this.
I went to see Australia because I was into tennis.
Yeah.
I still am a good tennis player. And I went to see Laver and where they came from because Australia used to dominate tennis in those days. Like, and I said, well, if 2 months ruins my career, then I don't have a career. That's what, and so I said, I'll take the gig.
Yeah.
And it changed my life. It was in Sydney for 2 months.
It was all Sydney?
All Sydney for 2 months.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
That's not what I expected at all.
Yeah. And the thing was, if it had been a week
or
a bunch of, I wouldn't be living here now.
But right.
Because it was a 2 month gig, 6 nights a week. And
What is this gig? I'm genuinely.
It was at a club called Kinsella's, which was an interesting club in the gay section of town, because I didn't know Sydney was the second biggest place in the world for gay people next to San Francisco. That's the that's the number one place. They have a gay Mardi Gras here that's on TV every year. And so I didn't know that at the time. So this club, Kinsella's, was in the gay section of town, the Paddington area. And I was only one of 3 straight people in the club, and they had about 27 people working there.
Right? Do you remember who you worked with for these 2 months?
I worked with Steve Bluestein and Bill Kirkenbauer.
Okay.
And Bill didn't like Australia, he didn't like the people. He, you know, they called his bluff because he was very temperamental, and, you know, he could run his bluff on club owners in America. And over here, they don't have a lot of time for temperamental people. They just don't have any patience for it. So Bill ran this thing. We used to do 30 minutes each, the 3 of us each night, right? And we alternate. You open this week. I'll do middle. I'll do whatever. We just alternate each week because we were there so long. Anyway, Bill got in. I walked up.
I feel like this ends with you closing all the shows, but I want to hear
it. No. I mean, so the thing was, Bill got into a dispute with the Aussies from the audience. And
during the show?
Yeah. I didn't know it till I got there because there was this big brouhaha where the club.
You can feel it when you walk in
the
room.
The club manager was
like
out
that.
Talking to these people, trying to keep them from kicking his ass. And it turned out that he had insulted some women from the stage. And even though Aussies are very chauvinistic, the men weren't going for that.
Yeah.
And they were going to kick his ass. They were furious. So we calmed him down. Me and Steve did our next, and it was cool. But the next day, the owner called us in, 3 of us. And said, you know, look, I'm not happy with this. He said, Franklin, you and Steve are fine. But what happened, Bill tried to say, well, I'll fuck this, I don't like that, and if you don't do this, I'm going home. And I never forget this, because you don't see this in the States. The cat sat back and he said, well, you know, Bill, we never had this problem until you came here, so you can go and we'll finish the rest of the month with... He just said it just as calm.
Right.
He said, we never had this problem until you came here. He called Bill's bluff. Bill hated that more. You know, he hated that more because he didn't want to leave that money on the table. Yeah. So he stayed, you know.
Oh, he stayed?
He absolutely.
Also, I mean, he didn't, to think, you know, Bill was a little, I wasn't there, obviously, but he didn't have a strong negotiating position. No. He wasn't a headlining show. Bill wasn't a superstar draw because he was able to come to Australia for just 2 months. Also, there's two other comedians on the
That's
bill.
Right.
It could just be like, you guys do 10 minutes more, and Bill,
yeah,
you know.
Split Bill's money. Everybody's Bill, like, I got 10 more minutes worth of jokes.
Quantas right there.
They just told him to go.
And we save on housing. Lift, lift, lift. You're riding in the lift, and you feel like Will Smith, and we dip. And I get a fucking spliff. Yo, lift. You know what it is. You understand it. You get it. It's Liff. They used to have the goofy ass pink mustache. They used to have the car. They would have the pink mustache on the outside of the car. Didn't they have it on the outside of the car? And the motherfucker would pull up with that and he would put it on the hood of the car. And then you'll get out and get in the car. And then he'd get out and pull the mustache back in. Well, they've gone beyond that goofy ass shit, and they've grown up. They're more subtle. So yeah, Lyft, you know what it is. Order a goddamn car. It comes, you drunk, you order the car. You didn't drive, you don't own a car. You don't feel like riding your stupid bike. You order a Lyft. You get the concept. You understand it. If you're really broke, you can use Lyft Line if you want to ride with some strangers and listen to what the fuck they're talking about. Sure, do it. I don't recommend it, but hey, everybody's doing differently. Anyways, right now Lyft is offering our listeners a special deal. Get 3 free rides up to $10 each. That's up to a $30 value with you enter the promo code HANDSOMERAMBLER. Just download the free Lyft app today and enter promo code HANDSOMERAMBLER in the payment section. You start with 3 free rides up to $10 each. That's up to a $30 value. That's promo code HANDSOMERAMBLER. HANDSOMERAMBLER. Live, live, lift, lift. Get in the lift. Feel like Will Smith. Life is a gift. Tokyo Drift.
If you don't like snacks, you're a bitch and a weirdo. What type of weirdo don't like snacks? Everybody likes snacks, so I'm not even talking to anybody right now. Nature Box got great snacks. So step your snack game up, stop being a weirdo, don't live life in a mediocre way. No matter what your income is, snacks is where you can truly live it up, no matter what your station in life. So stop being a bitch, step your snack game up, go to naturebox.com. My personal favorites are almonds and some other shit. Nature Box, they got all types of snacks. They switching up the snacks all the time. They really care about this shit. They care about snacks more than you will ever care about snacks, you pussy. Right now, you can save even more. Nature Box is offering Handsome Rambler fans 50% off your first order when you go to naturebox.com/rambler. That's naturebox.com/rambler for 50% off your first order. naturebox.com/ramblers. Get some snacks, you pussy.
But the thing that made me really change, because I was very depressed when I first came here, you know, was it got me away. So I could kind of reflect on the things that were bothering me. You know, I was away from friends. I was away from influences of this country. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of things that you're, when you're brought up, that, you know, I had to think about what is success? What do I want? Even your friends can give you bad advice, though it's well-intentioned, but it's not really what you need. And I remember I was 36 at the time, and I was very sad. And I said, well, I'm not really feeling good about my life. And if my next 36 years are like this, I don't see myself making it. I'm too depressed. And I remember thinking, so I'm going to figure out while I'm here why I'm so depressed. And that was what I really needed. I was focused on that because I was one of those people, you know, one of the comedians was going to had a therapist and all that. And that doesn't work for me. I'd go in once.
You would try therapy
one time. And I went, oh, I don't need to be. I can't. Yeah. This is not going to do it for me. I got to figure out this on my own.
I feel like therapists be snitching and shit. I'm not telling that names, but this one guy. Oh, him with the drinking.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Patient number 8. So
I just started thinking. I mean, I was meeting a lot of women too, which was kind of interesting because there were no straight men, very few straight men in Sydney. Up.
And how many black men were there?
I mean,
at that time, there was a guy actually who was coming to the club tonight. He was coming with me who was there. You know, he was an American and he recognized me. He lived in Sydney at the time. At the time, I didn't know that there were no straight men. And also, there were Aussie men are not gentlemen. So the women really don't really have a lot of good things to say about Australian men, and I didn't. So I was a gentleman.
Is that still hold now? Is that back then? Yeah.
Still to a certain degree, but you know, you'd find women that didn't have anything good to say about Australian men because Australian men ignore them and don't pay the attention to them. Because I would meet women and say, "Oh, you're really a lovely woman," and she said, "Thank you." I say, "You must hear that a lot." You would think because they say, "I never hear it."
Yeah,
And I say, really? So I was a gentleman. I was an American. I had an accent, which I didn't know.
Did you have dreadlocks back then?
No, I had short hair. I had an afro about like this.
Yeah.
Nice and neat. I was in really good shape. And
you were killing it.
Yeah, the women just needed attention. And I told them all. I said, look, I just broke up with this chick. I'm letting you know I'm just going to go out with whoever I can go out with. And they all said, that's fine. As long as when we go out, you pay attention to me. And I went, yeah, that's okay. And so that was an interesting thing.
Which was really easy because there was no cell phones then.
I used to get confused trying to keep all their details in. Because I'd focus on them. But, you know, they actually helped me. They're good women. They're very fair. Which is, you know, and they play no games. Absolutely zero games. And so if you come from L.A., which is really, I used to be confused because I would be meeting a lot of chicks in L.A. because I was a celebrity. But in a way, that didn't give me the confidence you would think it would, because I started thinking it's not really me. It's I'm a celebrity. So so when I came here and nobody knew who I was actually able to get a more objective view of what I had to offer a woman.
Right.
You know, which was, they liked my conversation. This is also a good place for a smart man. If you're smart here, you can really, they like that. The women are, it's a very mental country. They like a smart person. It's almost like it's almost sexy to them.
They have a term for that I hate.
What's that?
They say it's sapiosexual.
Sapiosexual, really?
You'll see women on their dating profile, they say, I'm a sapiosexual.
What does that mean?
They like smart people.
Oh, wow.
It's weird, though. I think it's stupid.
Isn't the root of that sapien, which is human?
I don't know, man. I think it's weak. I think it's a weak term, but...
Well, I didn't run into too many over there, especially in L.A. Maybe in New York it would have been better. You know, New York's got a higher quality...
Did you ever try New York?
Not to live.
No. To live, I meant, yeah.
No, no. I was, you know, the industry was out in L.A. And so, anyway, I used to stay up very late thinking, and then I came to this realization... I stayed actually, and also the Aussies were really happy people, which I never lived in a country without guns. I didn't live in a country that, they don't chase fame over here and success. It's not a ethos here. I never lived anywhere where that. I was brought up on the American thing. You got to chase the fame. And I had an element of, this is why I was confused, because I had an element of notoriety and I wasn't happy. So that's when I really realized, because I used to think, well, if I get better known, get a little bit more money in my pocket, I'll be happier. When that happened, and I wasn't. That's when I had to really work things out, you know. And I stayed for 3 months. And I remember one day I just said to myself, okay, I'm ready to go back. And what I resolved was I'm going to plant my feet. I remember, I can remember to myself. I said, I'm going to plant my feet. I'm going to figure out where I stand on everything, just where I stand, not where other people stand, not where my friends stand, but where I stand on every issue, and I'm not going to be influenced or buffeted by the opinions of others anymore, and I'll accept the consequences. I said this to myself, and I did accept the consequences, but from then on, I was a happy man.
What were the consequences?
Well, you know, I wouldn't compromise. You know, I just refused to compromise, and if it meant I wouldn't get a gig or something like that, I'd say, I don't want to compromise. My style is valid, and, you know, there was a lot of pressure on me to speed up, to do stuff, and I said, God damn it, this is it. You know, it's valid. If I wasn't getting laughs, I'd be listening to you. But as long as I'm getting laughs the way I want, that's the way I'm going to do it, period.
And also, it's not comedians telling you this. It's...
It was, you know,
executives and
bookers and stuff. Right. And I just went, I am not going to do it. I mean, some people might think that's, and then I came over here. I started working over here more because I felt, well, I got a place I can work. Because my attitude was, I don't have to be a success in America. I want to go, I tell people this, I want to go where I'm treated best. I want to go where people are on my wavelength. And I realized I didn't feel I was on the American wavelength. But I felt I was on the Australian wavelength. They're very low-key. They're very smart. They like witty. The Aussies are very... Their comedy on TV is terrible.
But
the people, they're witty.
Right. No, just talking to people, people are pretty
they're
funny.
They're witty.
Out here. Yeah.
And that surprised me because I'd be talking to them and think, well, I haven't laughed like this except in the States when I'm talking to a comedian.
Yeah. Wow. No, people just crack jokes.
They're witty and dry. They
women
like...
Women are sarcastic
yes.
as fuck, but just sharp and just will
and they like
say
dry.
Some shit that just
they like
cuts
dry.
You.
They call us your sense of humor my dry. They say, oh, he's got a dry sense of humor. They like that. Now, they like all kinds. You can do shtick. You can do bizarre stuff. You can be very cerebral. They like it all. Like the Comedy Festival, they got everything here, right? So I said, well, okay. You know, I've got some place where people, you know, let me be me. And if Americans won't let me be me. And then I got tired of the racial dynamics of America, the black-white racial dynamics. I can't handle that anymore. You know, I don't have it to deal with any of that here. And I saw that, and my brother came over to visit me, and he even noticed it, and so he moved here, and he lives in Canberra.
Really? He came and never left?
No, he never left. He's got...
Okay.
I mean, Hannibal's already kind of doing it. You've already extended your trip. We've been here 2 days. You already talking about...
Once that flight's so long, you got to relax a little
long.
Bit, man.
You're going to be saying that 21 years from now.
21 years. This flight's so long. My family here. Yeah. So that 2 month gig, right?
Yeah, which turned into, I extended it for a month myself. When the gig ended at 2, I remember telling Bluestein, who was, you know, very neurotic, and he would always be telling me about how his mother had done this and that, because he was Jewish. You know, all Jewish cats seem to have a lot of issues with their mom, you know. And I remember I was walking up to the club with him one night, and I said, you know, damn, Steve, you know, because I was seeing how happy these people were, and I wasn't used to that. And I said, you know, you're going to talk about your mother for the rest of your life. You know why you're fucked up now, so you got to change. It's not like you don't know why. And once you know why, you got to change. I got sympathy for people who don't know why, but you know why. So it's on you now to change, you know. And I said, these people can teach us a lot about how to be happy, and I'm going to stay for an extra month on my own dime to try to learn their secret of how to deal with life. And their thing is they don't complain. They don't complain about anything. And that was something I had not been used to, because in America, you're encouraged to complain. You know, and TV says, what's your pet peeve? You know, you see people on your shows, what really pisses you off? What gets in rants, you know, people are in. So there's a complaining thing to the American culture that's here. In fact, if you complain here, people will shun you. They call it, they'll say, it's funny, I learned that, they call it whinging. You hear it in England too. If you're a whinger, they hate the British because the British are whingers, complainers, right?
Right.
So,
and a lot of British comedy is based in complaining and self-deprecation. Yeah.
So if you sit down, you know, if you say, like over here in America, you know,
I'm a whinger.
Yeah.
I got lots of shit to
whinge
about.
Well, they shut you down. You know how they shut you down? It's funny because they say, like you go in for a drink and I say, how's your life? And you start to give them a little sad story. They'll listen to it for about a minute, and then they'll say, she'll be right. And that means, shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
That means...
That's a polite
way of saying. They'll say, she'll be right, mate. And that means, let it go. So, you know, and I thought, well, that's great. That's fucking great. That's what I need. because we can indulge, you know, we can all indulge over much in our complaints, right? And I said, and in America, they would, you know, kind of encourage it. You know, oh, tell me about it. You know, ah, oh, life's not going to go. Oh, really? You want to talk about it?
Yeah.
You're right. Now tell you. And I'll listen to that sad story for 20 minutes, right?
Yeah, an American bartender, his role is to, hey, tell me about it. Yeah, therapist, yeah.
So here, so I said, okay. All right, I need that. I need to know how to do that. And then I became a person who just was able to roll with life a lot better.
Yeah.
The punches, you know, ups and downs. And when I went back, Buddy Mora.
What year is this again?
This is 85.
85.
I went and did a set at the Improv. And Buddy Mora, who used to manage Robin and all of those cats, he was in the audience. And he came up to me afterwards. I knew him. And he said, Franklin, you know, he didn't know I'd been in Australia. He said, you know, Franklin, I just saw your set. And there's really something different about you. And I went, ah, buddy, what the fuck are you talking about? It's the same material I've been doing. He said, no, it's not. There's something different about you. I went, wow. He had picked up on something in me, a calmness, I guess. So, you know, once I kind of got my feet, I just became this kind of a lone wolf kind of guy, you know. Even moving over here, all my friends thought I was crazy.
Because that's when you really ghost, 85?
Yeah.
Ain't no checking in.
There's no connection.
$7 a minute to call, you gone, for real. So,
but I didn't move over here till 97.
Okay. Oh.
But I would come over in vacation.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to,
see those girlfriends that you...
I did pretty well here, yeah. But Sydney, I never did as well as in Sydney, because here is more heterosexuals, but in Sydney, I just... You know, that was actually... Plus, the women were so easy to get along with that... And I'd had two chicks in the States who were really high maintenance, you know? And so I realized that you didn't have to... The chicks were smart. Plus, the culture here is women pay their way.
Yeah.
Okay.
I noticed that my first trip.
They pay their way. And if you try to pay for them, that's when they get mad. Or they get a little bit. They'll let you know, don't do that.
Yeah, I tried...
That happened to me in Scotland. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I tried to buy... My first trip out here... In Melbourne in 2011, I was out with this girl and I tried to buy her a drink, and she was like, "No, I'll get my own drink." And I said, "Oh, this night is over."
Right.
But then everything went well, and we.
No, you can buy the drink, but they'll say, "Well, the next one's on me," and it's an amazing thing, and that kind of right away that takes a little pressure off you. Because, you know, I remember thinking about, well, you know what, they're invested in the evening. Like, it's not like I got to show them a good time. It's like we got to show each other a good time.
Also, they're approaching evening.
They're straight ahead. Like, if they don't feel anything, they won't go out with you the second time because they don't feel it. And then and that's kind of interesting. You first, it's a jolt when you call them up. You think things went well, and they said, nah. But they don't want to waste their money. I can understand that they don't want to put any more money into something they don't really see having a future. So you really kind of get if they're out with you the second time, you kind of know they really like you.
Right. Yeah. Whereas an American girl would be like, hey, it's another free dinner.
Exactly.
Food, aren't you? You're not going to go out with them? You're hungry, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm hungry. Fuck that motherfucker.
Yeah, I had a chick say, oh, yeah, I'll do that. I'll go. American chicks say, yeah, if I want a good dinner or go to a good concert, I'll do that. And then they break the cat's heart when they say, oh, I don't think of you that way. You know, then you know. But over here.
It's after the band says, thank you, good night, and they don't feel that way anymore.
So that was I said, okay. I haven't been able to go out with an American chick since, to be honest. I can't put up. I tried. But when I try to explain to them, hey, let's kind of go, you know, they don't want to hear let's go Dutch. And they think you're just a cheap motherfucker. You know what I mean? And I just actually ruled them out. It's only deal with Aussie girls. But at my age, I'm having a tough time. At 67, that's a motherfucker. That's a whole nother game.
Man.
That's a whole nother fucking game.
What's the single scene like at 67?
It's pathetic.
That's what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
That's if you want to go out with women with figures. Because older women, you know, 50 and above, which is like, till I was 52, I could still catch women in their 20s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Here. I could still 27, 28.
Did something, what happened? You felt?
I went through the Twilight Zone, that wall where you walk, you know, I catch used to say, man, why are you still, plus, you know, the chicks here are young chicks. They're so smart. It's not like going out with a young chick, right?
Yeah.
But catch would say, why are you still hit on these young chicks, you know, and I said, well, because I can still catch them, number one. I mean, yeah. That's why.
You answered your own question.
Yeah. I mean, I told a cat, I said, you know, one day, and it's funny, I said, you know, one day, I said, I can still catch them. My dreadlocks were dark, you know. I was still pretty trim. I'm still pretty trim. And I could still catch them, meet them on the street, charm them, go out with them.
Street moving, like, that's a tough, like, walking past, that's a tough.
Oh, streets, trams, that's how I used to meet them, because I wouldn't go meet them in clubs. I, you know, they're friendly women, because there's not a lot of predator shit here, you know, so they're not scared of men, strangers, you know. American accent also disarms them a little bit. You say, hey, how are you? They hear an accent. And so, you know, it's like an Australian guy in America, same thing, you know. Hey, girl, you know, guy, chico here in Aussie accent. So they're a little bit more open, and if you're polite, which I am, they'll listen. And so, but then when you get right at 52, I had this chick 27, and then I had a chick 35. And then all of a sudden, the same approach, you know, I was still here, just wasn't working. It just, you know, it was like, I told this cat before, I said, well, there's going to come a time when no matter what I do, I'm not going to be able to catch a young girl, a younger woman, you know. So why should I retire before that happens? Why should I quit
before it happens? Push it to the limit.
Yeah, because it's going to happen.
That's awesome.
Right.
It's going to fucking happen. And it did.
Right.
Yeah. 52 was like, I told Pat, I said, it's like I was in a Twilight Zone episode. I'm with these chicks. All of a sudden, there's this invisible wall. I walk through. I look back, and the chicks are on that wall, and I can't get back. I can't get back to them. So then it becomes, all right, I got my friend tonight. He used to be a real ladies man. He's 55, right? Yeah. Still good looking cat, but same thing, the younger women, and he still likes, you know, you like the women with a shape or figure, right? Yeah. And women 50 and above, a lot of them don't take care of themselves. They've had kids, you know, they've let themselves go. Yeah. Women 60s, you know. So my age, I'm 67. You can't see me with a 67-year-old chick. You know, I can't.
That's real. What's up, y'all? That's my 67-year-old girlfriend.
I mean, that's what most people do, right, date that. Yeah. But I mean, when I look at them, because I give them a look, you know, I mean, I'm walking down the street and I'm saying, if I could see an older woman that's, you know, catches my attention. But so then it's like, okay. Then when I try my approach on the younger woman, which was pretty charming, but I noticed I couldn't get him to go have coffee with me. Like, yeah. I hit on these two chicks down there at the desk. One, the little French chick at the desk.
Yeah.
She's a cutie pie. Man. And Celine is her name, and the one out front is Denny.
Yeah.
Now, both of them got boyfriends, but, you know.
Denny, the one with the
striped, or, yeah.
Okay, good intel.
She's from Manchester, England.
Right.
Okay. And I was chatting him up.
Goddamn.
Yeah. I was doing a very good job, too. I was doing a fucking good job. Had him smiling, laughing.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know if I'd have... They both have boyfriends, you know, and, you know. But I don't know if I... But but what I found is I couldn't close the deal anymore. That was the problem at my age. Because now when I walk up to a chick, they see an old guy. That's the thing. No matter, you may feel young, but when they turn... They see a guy that they're not really, that's out of their age range. You really need a really broad thinking woman to think, oh, I'll go out with this older cat. But most of them, you know, a friend of mine, another cat, said the same thing. He said, age is the, he used to have a lot of good, he said, age is the greatest obstacle, man. It can't be beat. And, you know, he was right. I should have come here about 5 years earlier. Come back. I stayed in America till I was... 2013. I should have come about 2010. Mm. I think I. But when I got over here, you know, when I knew that shit had changed, I met this chick. I'm walking down Swanson and I see this drop dead fucking gorgeous Chinese, you know, Asian chick with just legs. Legs are my thing. I gotta have the legs. Yeah, some cats need ass, but I got the leg. I need the legs. Fuck the ass. I need the legs. Right? She went into this little shop right over here on Swanson Street, and I. That's what I got to get. And I followed her in. And I said, oh, I just walked, you know, my thing was always be very direct. I said, I just walked in just to tell you, I think you're really one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen. And she blushed and smiled. I said, oh, thank you very much. And I said, well, you know, and I started to walk away. And then I thought, yeah, fuck it, I'm going to take a chance.
Yeah.
And I said, listen, you know, would you like to have a coffee right now? And she said, well, you know, I normally don't do this, but yeah. I went, fuck, you still got this shit, man. Yeah. I thought to myself. We walked over right across the street. We're sitting up for about 15, 20 minutes. The shit is just sparkling. You know, it's just a shit sparkling.
Immediate coffee date.
Coffee date, and she's engaged, and we're having a beautiful... And then all of a sudden, out the fucking blue, she says, how old are you? And I went, oh, fuck, to myself. I said, and I told her the truth. At the time, I was 65. She was gone in about 2 minutes, man.
Really? Oh, man.
And I went, oh.
Do you regret telling the truth?
I've never lied, but, you know.
That was, if you were going to do it, that was the time to do it.
Yeah, because I was thinking, if I can get her out a couple of times.
Right.
You know, and then get to that. Because, like, when my girl, my 27-year-old girl, I was 52, and I didn't tell her till the third time. But we were hitting it off so good, I thought, I need to tell her how old I am, because I know I don't look my age. And I sat her down at this little place, and I said, I need to tell you how old I am.
This is serious meeting. This is
this is serious.
I'm just picturing you before you meet up with her, like pacing. And you're like, Franklin, thinking, you got to do this. All right, this
you
time.
Do. Because I said, she, you know, I know I don't look my age.
She's thinking you about to tell her you got herpes or something.
It's like, that's all.
I'm 52.
So I said, you know, I got to tell you how old I am. And she said, okay. I said, well, I need you to know I'm 52. And I was. She just got up and came around and sat on my lap and said, it's okay, it's all right. But I'd been out with her a couple of times. And right. We'd had a great time.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and I was hope. But when I said 65, man, it was like the wall just
came. That yeah. same invisible wall came down.
She was gone in 2 minutes. And I went, phew, man, this is going to be harder than I thought. Mm. You know, my friend used to lie. He used to lie till they could check his age on the internet.
Oh, man.
They busted him a couple of times,
yeah.
You know, on the internet. But I went, now what am I going to do? And that, at 67, it's like, you know, you're in a whole nother zone. I got this chick coming tonight who's 49, right?
Yeah.
That's what's up.
That's not bad. We'll see. I, you know. Yeah. I mean, I realized that that's where I got a fish now. If that's a big gap. For some of them, you know? It's hard, man. I ain't lying. It's hard.
Yeah.
You know, I look at these young boys. They don't deserve these young women. They don't fucking deserve them. These motherfuckers don't know how to know what the fuck to do with these chicks. I see these square-ass motherfuckers with these chicks.
Yeah.
You know, these beautiful chicks, man.
Hey, man, you know how you get the young ones again. You got to start back doing stand-up.
You know, it's tempting, but
me and this brother batted way out of my league for a long time.
You're probably right.
Yeah, man.
I'm watching CISO. I'm watching CISO with about 25 CISO. He-ho. CISO, S-E-E-S-O. The new ad-free. No ads. This, you won't hear this on CISO. CISO will advertise on other platforms, but they don't have ads. They believe in the power of advertising, but they don't want to burden your eyes with that. It's crazy. Advertising is the only thing that you can advertise. Advertise. Like, hey, you want to advertise right here? You want this bench? You want your face on this bench? And then you put your face on the bench, and now it's advertising you instead of advertising the fact that you could use that for whatever. CISO. Every episode of SNL. SNL, so you can look up that weird ass Michael Jordan sketch from years ago. It's great, man. It's great. CISO is ad free. $3.99 a month. $3.99 a month, that's $48 a year. Or that's $47.88 a year if one of you math nerds want to be a bitch about it. CISO. Right now, my listeners can try CISO free for 2 months. 2 months.
2 months. 2 months.
2 months.
2 months.
2 months. 60 days.
Days.
58 or 59 if one of your months is February. Shows you can't get anywhere else. Original series, Take My Wife, Harmon Quest, Just go to CESO.com, CESO.com right now to sign up for 2 months free. Promo code RAMBLER. CESO.com, promo code RAMBLER.
Probably so
you
right.
You said you haven't been on stage since
2013. That's when I let it. I just kind of went. I've said, you know, I just feel like I've said everything I wanted to say as well. Mm-hmm. And that was another thing. I didn't want to be looking for new material anymore. That was, you know, it's kind of like, my friend, she says, oh, you know, you're still funny because I'm still pretty funny when you chat and stuff.
Yeah,
and, you know,
and stuff hilarious like right now.
Yeah. And so she said, and I said, you know, there's no easy way to be good. Because she said, I said, there's no easy way to be good. I mean, I can't. People don't know that. I mean, I'd have to be serious about getting my material because I don't want to do old stuff. So I'd have to be really focusing on what's going on. I don't really want to work nights anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it's for me, you know, I never was a night guy like a lot of performers. I'm a day guy. I'm up at 6 every morning. So I said, there's no easy way to be good. I'd have to be serious about it because I can't just walk up there and bullshit people. And
yeah.
So... But I don't miss it.
Right.
You know, all my friends miss it. But I don't miss it. You know, I get as much of a kick making my friends laugh, talking to them as going on stage, you know, myself.
Yeah. So it's been 3 years. And was those last few years, like 2010 to 2013, were you doing it a lot or did it kind of...
I was trying to get back on TV. So I'd go down to the... Comedy and Magic Club where you could they would DVD you, you they tape you, you know, and you could and I sent it, you know, I sent it to all of the shows. I had this really funny 5-minute, you can actually see some of it on YouTube actually. Yeah. Some of my Comedy and Magic, and I said, okay, let me put together a really sharp, because I knew my age. For example, this guy who used to book Letterman, he came out, I knew him, Eddie Brill. So he came out to the Uptown show, which was right, and he said, I'm scouting for Letterman. So I went down and I did this really funny set, and he had all these young comics. And he came up and he said, man, you still got it, man. Your stuff is still really, really sharp, man. I'll be getting in touch with you when I go back. And then I got, about a month later, they called. He said, I ran your name by Dave, and Dave said he's too old, period.
Wow.
Yeah. That was it. Dave said, nah, he's too
motherfucker,
old.
You old.
Yeah.
Like, don't you have a white beard?
Yeah. So, you know, part of me said, okay. So, you know, I tried to get on Craig Ferguson. I tried to get on Leno. And I found that I couldn't get on. Elaine Boozler had warned me because she couldn't get on TV anymore. I was here and I asked her, what's the scene like when I come back to the... She said, well, I can't get on TV. That's why she retired. She said, I can't promote my gigs. You know, she'd made a shitload of money. So, you know, she said, I can't get on any of the TV shows and I'm not really up for the fight anymore. And that's really what I really found at that age was, I'm not up for the fight to get noticed anymore. And if this is where, you know, I'm happy with what I've done... I have no regrets. I don't have any bitterness. I did my best. My attitude is I did my best, and I finished up ahead of the game, and okay. And because I don't want to live my life. I'm very committed to not living my life angry or frustrated like some people I know. I know some people who are, and you know, and I just said, I just want to clear all of that out. I want to, you know, live and enjoy life. So I just want to live. I had a friend who told me, he said, I can get you college gigs. I can get you this before I left. He was trying to keep me there, you know. And I said, I just want to live now, man. That's all. You know, I'm not interested in trying to build my profile anymore. I don't need the money, you know. So
you saved well and invested? Or?
No, I'm just homeless. When you're homeless, you don't need any fucking money. Yeah, I did. I was always, from day one, I was very cognizant of the need to save my money and invest it, because I'd seen the cautionary tales of entertainers that had ended up bankrupt. And so I knew... money for me was freedom. I never wanted a lot of acquisitions. I didn't need three cars. I said, you know, give me a nice little house and a car. I have a nice little condo that I own over here in a really good section of town that is, you know, then when I bought it, I just bought it because I liked it. But now that's one of the hottest areas in the city. You can't even get in there, and it's amazing. But I'm not thinking about moving. But I always saved with the idea of I don't want to have to do a gig because I need the money.
Right.
You know, I don't want to have to do. So I would save, and my acquisitions were, and I invested pretty well in real estate, and I invested in shares, and so I did it all.
Yeah.
You know, and like I say, you know, I tell people there are people with a lot of more money than me, but they're not living any better than me. I can do whatever I want. I could buy whatever I want, but I just really buy books and DVDs by Hannibal.
That's cool.
No, it's, you know, it's, but my biggest obstacle is, you know, if I had a good lady that I was attracted to, my life would be pretty much perfect. That's really been the struggle, you know, just because of age. Yeah. I'm still charming.
Have you tried Tinder?
No, I'm not doing that
shit. Hey, man, you never know, man.
I don't know. This shit knocks a lot of shit out the box, man.
Yeah.
It does. And the gray, it just knocks a lot of shit out the box, man.
Oh,
man,
you'd be surprised how many women like that, man. For real. For real, bro.
You're like that Chinese chick didn't. And all these chicks that I've been, you know. Yeah.
Here's what I was wondering about the retiring and stopping stand-up. Did you just feel the shift over time in your thought process, or just how you, because I'm always, my brain is just constantly just going about stuff, or that this thing that happened yesterday, or this person, or how they moved their body, and that all types of stuff like that. Just, and so is it just you don't have the desire to do stand up and your mind is still operating the same, or do you feel like more relaxed mentally?
I'm a lot more, you know, look, I was a fairly, once I, the bottom line was, once I kind of had that epiphany back in 85, which kind of put me, you know, eliminated my neurotic side, you know, that's, and my insecurities. And I became just a person that was fairly confident without being arrogant about just going through life, you know, and kind of easy, comfortable with myself, you know. And I think the journey in life, I tell people, is to find out who you are, you know, in a way. And a lot of people never find out who they really are. And I remember that, I remember thinking to myself, I found out who I am. I'm a serious, you know, when I was a comedian, I was always wrestling with my serious nature versus the demands of the profession.
Right.
And the fact that people would always want me to be on.
Yeah.
Okay. I remember once in Seattle, I had to do a really early morning show to promote my gig, and I just was sick of that
morning radio show. Yeah.
And I went in, and I wasn't in the mood to do any jokes. And the DJ said, "Okay, let me in. What jokes do you want to do?" You know, during the commercial. I said, "I'm not going to do any jokes." I mean, he said, "Hey, you know, you're like, what the fuck?" He said, what are we going to do then? I said, man, just...
Let's just talk, man.
I said, just talk to me. And he was like, fuck, yeah, fuck. And I was adamant. I didn't give a fuck at that. So he did. So he started asking me questions. And we had a really nice conversation. Every now and then I might say something a little witty, but basically serious. And then at the end he said, you know, that's the best fucking interview he said I've ever done. Well, anyway, what happened was I had a sold-out gig that week. And people came up to me after the show, and I said, how did you know I was in town? They said, well, we heard you on that show, and you were so interesting, we decided to see what type of sense of humor you had. We didn't...
Wow.
Yeah, that's what they said. You were just such an interesting person. We said, let's go see what kind of sense of humor you
had. Right.
So I realized that the audiences, you know, they don't mind that.
Right.
But your program... So it was always, for me, a real battle of trying to stay true to my nature.
Yeah.
And also, you know, do that. And so once I kind of got out of it, it's like I just went, okay, my mind doesn't really, I don't have what you're talking about where I'm still looking anymore, you know, for the next oddity or, you know, which is what you're looking for, something that strikes you, strikes you a little bit odd, or you notice, or you think about it, you know, I'm not doing that anymore. You know, it's really inadvertent now if I'm funny. And so I'm relaxed about that. And I know, I call it the antenna, you know. If I were to get back, I'd have to put the antenna back up.
Right.
You know, reading the paper. I used to read the paper looking for, you know, all kinds of stuff. Because I was doing a lot of global material by the end of my career. I was no longer doing, I wasn't married. You know, a lot of my friends, you know, they marry. And so their material goes from being single to being married with kids. That's a traditional thing for, and I never married. And so I started focusing not on political stuff, but actually global events. I was one of the few comedians really doing stuff about Russia and Zimbabwe and stuff, and which was really, that's when I felt I was better than Richard.
Right.
Because I went, well, he can't, you know, he could never broaden out like this. And I was making people crack up about tragic stuff, you know, that I would. So I had really, but I had to, because I couldn't fall back on, oh, my kids are doing this, or my wife is giving me grief. You know what I mean? Yeah. Which a lot of cats.
It'd be weird if you just wrote those jokes anyway.
Yeah. So I'm talking about getting somebody pregnant just for the material. Oh, she has weird cravings. Yeah. Oh, the baby. Oh, now the baby sucking on those titties. Those used to be my titties.
Yeah. So I said, well, how am I going to stay? And so I was really into, you know, world affairs. And they have a lot of world news over here. They show that they won't, you know, America shows focuses on mostly, but here there's a network, SBS, and they really, it's all global. And I'd see what was going on in Zimbabwe or Indonesia or Malaysia, you know, things that Americans wouldn't even know what was going on. But I would
know that they existed.
Yeah. And I enjoyed walking out on stage and talking to the audience about something that that they didn't know about, but I was going to entertain them and educate them at the same time in a funny way. And I really got a kick out of that, because I was bringing up stuff that a lot of people didn't know about. And that was like a real challenge. It's like you're bringing up stuff, and how do you've got to, and they enjoyed kind of going on the journey, you know, with me and stuff like that. So, you know, but no, man, I don't miss it. I thought about maybe writing a series. My last gasp, I created a series, you know, when I saw Louie and Curb Your Enthusiasm. And so I created this series because I play clarinet too. And I thought, I'm going to create a thing where I'm a little musician in L.A. You know, I was going to make, my character's going to be 50, but he's going to be dating some young, he's going to be hip, going to be a musician. It's hilarious. I wrote 3 scripts. Hilarious. I couldn't sell that motherfucker, man. I went to Showtime, I went to HBO. Larry David loved it. He actually sent it to HBO for me. He loved it. And Larry doesn't like a lot of shit. And he said, you know, he's a grumpy motherfucker. And he said, you know, let me see your scripts. I sent him the scripts. And, you know, a couple weeks later, these are great. These are great. You know, he sent me this little email. These are great. You know, send them to HBO for you. You know, I said, cool. You know, but they didn't. And then IFC.
Yeah,
you know, I think
that would be perfect for IFC.
I did too, but the cat and they said no, we can't. It won't get any traction here, and I went, well, that's it. I'm shutting it down. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That's it. I went, you know, because I felt I could do something very provocative. You know, I had one episode where my character ends up with this really young chick who likes to be choked while you fuck her and stuff like that, because that happened to me in real life. I had this gorgeous chick.
Like choked, or she just where you touched the neck.
Some girls like to be choked.
Sometimes you can't really choke.
Like she told
double,
me
double hand.
She took my hands and I
like
said,
Undertaker choked.
And I went. And she told me, man, this is what I want you to do. And I said, oh fuck. Yeah. I did for 3 months.
Hopefully not straight.
Look. Well, all right.
You know, I mean, I did, but I was always worried.
Because she would change her mind?
Well, no, she would really get it, and it made a difference, because she'd be super, it'd be, man, because she said, it's got to be hard, it's got to be really hard. Oh, and I'm thinking, and I wasn't into that, but I'd say, well, you know, I'll try this. Oh, and then she would really, really turn her on. And, you know, I say, well, you know, she'd get really worked up, and I'd be thinking to myself, yeah, you better have an orgasm, because I'm facing 25 of life. And then, you know, and then I just, I couldn't do it anymore, and I said, look, I'm sorry, but you know, I can't be choking you anymore. You know, it's just that's something I can really do. You know,
yeah.
And that's when that relationship kind of went down. Because she liked it. And, you know, I told people, you know, you can't change the way you're wired.
Right.
You know, I'm sure whoever with her now is choking her.
Yeah. That's what she wants. That's what she is to.
I mean, that's what she wants. You know,
every time, though?
Every time.
Every time, just a strong choking. That's heavy. That got to be like weekends, man. Like it's every time. Even like 2 p.m. post lunch sex. Just a long post lunch.
I'm telling you, man.
That's too much, man.
And if I tried to get out of choking her, you know, like.
If I tried to get out of it.
I did. I tried all kinds of. Well, maybe I'll try this trick. I tried all kinds of shit. But she'd move her head over, you know what I mean? Time to choke me.
Well.
This is fun, but yeah. It's time to get choked.
Yeah. Give you a wrap it up sound. Wow.
Well. Wow. Shit. Well, what? Hollywood, you blew it.
But that was here. That was here? That was a chick.
Well,
from,
I'm saying they blew it, not taking those stories.
Beautiful. Man. Beautiful chick, man.
You take her out, she looking at other men's hands. You're like, oh, that would fit right around my neck.
Sometimes I think, I wonder who's choking her these days.
Every time.
You know, who's choking her now?
Oh, man.
Yeah, that was something. But that's educational shit. Because I felt, you know, that is. It's educational. Because I feel like every woman I've been with, in a way, or every event, teaches you more about the reality of life as opposed to what you've been taught. Like, you know, here's a woman who was a very intelligent woman, smart. You would never, you know, you don't
think, oh, because she's a lawyer. She don't like that shit hard.
But she
don't like to get fucked hard and yelled at. Yeah.
So that taught me more about the individuality of people.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they don't have to be crazy. You know, the illusion is... Not the illusion, but the assumption is, you know, only crazy people are into that type of rough sex and stuff. And afterwards you say, okay, I know a little bit more about life now. It helps me be more open-minded when I deal with people. Because I know that, you know, you just have to be prepared for really all kinds of individuals. And they are here. You know, I'm not really into judging people, you know, who aren't doing dangerous things to other people, right? So I always feel like each of those things teach me more. I would have never, you know, I never dealt with a chick that needed to be choked. And all of a sudden there's one in your life. How do you deal with it?
Yeah.
You know, how do you really handle this? Do you say, I'm not into that? But then you say, well, you know, would that make me selfish if I don't choke her and stuff
right.
like that? Hey, I would be selfish.
Trying to be the bigger person.
You know what I mean? But
my wrists are feeling weak this week.
You know?
Yeah.
But that was an interesting experience, you know? Yeah. Absolutely.
All right.
Anyway, but look how much longer we gotta go because I gotta get back home.
I was like trying to figure out a way to wrap it up, and then you went into this compelling choking story.
Hello, I'm Chris Gethard, and here with me is dream analysis expert
Gary Richardson.
And we are here to give you a taste of a brand new podcast called In Your Dreams, presented exclusively by the fine folks at Casper.
We listen to the wildest, weirdest dreams submitted to us by you, our listeners. And we do our best to figure out just what those dreams could possibly mean.
I look over the side of my bunk bed, and there are Huey Lewis in the news.
You're saying this person might have interests in style and fashion specifically. You can tell that from that voicemail.
99% certainty.
Plus, we'll be joined by some very special guests.
The word brutality comes to mind.
Mortality?
Blood.
Bloodtality.
Subscribe to In Your Dreams right now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Good night.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.